What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Halper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Halper. If you like the show, please leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary feature film, and more. Hello, and welcome to The Katie Halper Show. So excited to be here with you guys tonight. I'm right now in Amsterdam, where I'm working on a documentary that you guys have probably heard of about Holocaust survivors who are speaking out against the genocide in Gaza. I was here in Brussels and Amsterdam. I also spoke at a really great night with Yanis Varoufakis and Grace Blakely and Melanie Schweitzer in Brussels. So you can expect more on that once I'm back in the States. I'll play some clips from that. But tonight we have a really exciting show for you. Before I start that show, though, make sure you do give this stream a thumbs up. Also, subscribe to The Katie Halper Show if you aren't already subscribed by hitting subscribe and then the bell. And of course, you can support us at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. So tonight's show is a really cool double feature. First, I'm playing part of a recording of a sold out live show that we did in Dublin, Ireland last year. We hadn't released it before because we thought we lost the video from it, which really sucked. We thought that we had audio, which is great, but it turns out we have audio and video. So we're really excited to play part of this live taping for you. And when I say live taping, it was live and in person at Fumbly Stables in Dublin. It wasn't live streamed. Okay, so who is in this really exciting show? Well, we had Danny Morrison, who is a writer and a former Republican prisoner from West Belfast. He was also the national director of publicity for Sinn Féin in the 1980s, and he is a cultural and political commentator. It was also with Asad Abu Sharq, a Palestinian-Irish academic from Gaza and an international spokesperson of the Great March of Return. And Asad and Danny co-edited the book A Shared Struggle, Stories of Palestinian and Irish Hunger Strikers. So we're also releasing this right now because March 9th was the birthday of Bobby Sands, who was the leader of the 1981 hunger strike in which Irish Republican prisoners protested against the removal of special category status. Bobby Sands died on hunger strike at the age of 27, and Danny Morrison was not only a spokesperson for Bobby Sands, but he also is the secretary of the Bobby Sands Trust, which is dedicated to cultural productions related to Bobby Sands. So it's a perfect timing. Now, the full show will be available at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, and that features the brilliant comedian Tig Hickey, who was there in spirit. He was there via video. He was supposed to be there in person, but he was sick with COVID. But we do have him joining the discussion over video. So again, that will be available at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. The second part of the show is a really great interview, hopping from Ireland to England, and it's with three members of the organization Holocaust Survivors and Descendants Against the Gaza Genocide, and that'll be played right after the Ireland section. So enjoy this Ireland session, and I'm also going to make sure to link in the description to a very important petition about Mahmoud Khalil, who is the Columbia University student who was basically abducted by ICE. So make sure you look for the link in the description because we have to make sure that he gets freed.
I'm really excited to welcome my two of my guests tonight, our guests tonight, Asad Abu Sharq and Danny Morrison. And okay. And Assad is an academic. He's also the international spokesperson for the March of Return. Danny is a former Republican prisoner and writer, playwright, and the secretary of the Bobby Sands Trust. And they both wrote really amazing essays in this amazing book called The Shared Struggle, Stories of Palestinian and Irish Hunger Strikers, which, by the way, is co-edited by Yousef Al-Jamal, who is a great writer and also was a student of Rafat Al-Arir, who was, as people probably know, killed by Israel in a targeted bombing of his sister's apartment. So just wanted to mention Yousef and also Rafat. And those are, you know, the people who we are here for, people like Yousef and Rafat. I wanted to start off the conversation by asking each of you how you got to where you are, by your trajectory. So let's start with you, Assad. How did you even come to be in Ireland?
Thank you very much for this question. Actually, it was a little journey for me to come to Ireland. It was in the 70s of last century. I had always liked to do postgraduate studies. It was my chance that there was an international conference, Muslim Christian conference, where I met two great Irishmen. I must name them. Professor Eustace Hegel, professor of education at the University of Galway. He was also the chairman of the education department. And TD from Funafon, Sean Shaw. And then I was explaining to them, because I was working at that time as a journalist, I was interviewing them. I explained the situation between them. They told me, don't worry, we will fix you up in Ireland. Give me your papers, which they did. They paved the way for me. They changed my future. And actually, I came. I liked the country. I studied in Trinity in UCD. I met fabulous professors, fabulous Irish people. Everything was fabulous for me. I got 3 degrees from UCD and 1 degree from TCD. This is why I decided to bring my son to study with Trinity, which he finished this year, a first degree, and now he's moving from Trinity to UCD. So this is how because I was very active here against the anti-apartheid movement, South African anti-apartheid movement, and I was very active in the Irish movement from that time. So I met this great man, Tanya Morrison, and we did a book together. With, of course, Yousef translated the stories of the hunger strikers. And we read the book where he was myself. And we did a great job. And we decided to continue our study. And we are continuing the study. And we are working together at this moment for Palestine, not only for Palestine, but also work for the freedom of Palestine and for the unity of Ireland. Thank you.
Yeah. Danny, can you tell us about your trajectory and then also how you first became interested in Palestine?
Well, I was born in West Belfast from the name Morrison. We were originally Scottish Presbyterians. Somebody jumped ship along the way. And we ended up in Fagans. But both my grandfather and my father and the Morrison family remained pretty pro-British. So my grandfather fought in the First World War, Second World War. My father joined the RAF towards the end of the Second World War. On my mother's side, her older brother, Harry White, had become the chief of staff of the IRA in the 1940s. He was involved in bombing England. And they had been sentenced to death in the South for shooting dead a special branch mob in a gun battle. That was later, it was an international campaign for clemency. It was commuted. And he was always known about, he lived in Dublin, he would come down to spend our summer holidays there. But despite having those family influences, the biggest influence on my life was what I witnessed on the street. So for example, whenever I was 11 years of age, Ian Paisley threatened him on the Flores Road and removed a tricolour from the window of an election of a student's band So the ex-prisoner had it on under an independent label. The RUC came in, broke the windows, a huge riot broke out, lasted a full week. And then in 1966, when we were commemorating the 50th anniversary of the 1968 rising, the Stormont government banned all transport to come to the US Belfast. And as a result, because we celebrated, that was 13 day, I remember it was a huge march. But as a result of that march, loyalist paramilitaries assassinated two Catholics in the pub, including my next door neighbour, Peterborough. So, you know, at a very early stage, you realise something was wrong. So when I was 15, I was really involved in politics, ran newspapers. For a short time, I joined People's Democracy after the civil rights movement started. And the greatest influence was, we followed the Yasser Arafat, BLO. We followed what was going on in South Africa, VANC, and the arms struggle there. We absolutely followed a protest, and I was on protest with the Vietnam War. And then when it came to our door in August 1969, I was still pacifist, did not add along her,
right?
And had no time for violence whatsoever. But it was what I saw at the RUC, would shoot your dead 90-year-old boy's bed, beaten to death, somebody by the bunch of his family. British soldiers gassing the false road in helicopters, shooting dead fine people, including the leader of our youth club. That transformed my generation. And we began to see that we were not going to get our civil rights unless we got our national rights. And that before we ended the season. So I decided to get involved in Republican movement as a student at A levels at the time. And I ended up interned in Wancash. I got out, I was back on the run at Gale. And there was a jail 3 times after. Last time I was in jail was 3 years. And in jail, you know, I was the chair of Sinn Féin in the H box. But before that, I was the editor of a public news, Sinn Féin newspaper. And when I took over in 1975, we published Palestinian Solidarity News of England. There was always up there amongst one of the critical litmus tests of whether you're a human being and an abolitionist and a progressive. And a Morris, Palestine was always conquered, so important to our people.
I wanted to know if you guys could share a little bit about actually the historical links, not just between Palestinians and Irish freedom fighters and hunger strikers, but also British imperialists, because you were mentioning some of the people who were involved. You know, obviously before Israeli Zionists were involved, the British were involved. So can you talk about that history?
Of course we can talk about this. Because, you see, it was 1917, Second World War, 1972, Balfour, at that time was the British foreign minister, gave his infamous declaration in which he promised to give Palestine to the Jews. And then the Palestinian people have no rights at that time because according to the document, his government's view will favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. And then when it comes to the Palestinian people, that the Palestinian people are regarded as communities with civil rights, religious rights. The Jews are having a national home. And they are having political rights. They have all sorts of rights. And the Palestinians are non-entity. This is where it started. Balfour Declaration, 1917. Ever since, of course, he was at that time cooperating with the Zionist movement, with Herzl and those people who came after Herzl, who weaponed on the destruction of the Palestinians. Because in the Zionist story, it said, will establish in Palestine a state for Jews, all Jews and only Jews. When Herzl was asked about the Palestinians, he said, we will drive all Arabs across the borders and those left behind will be used to cleanse the land of the reptiles or to be used as wood hewers and water drawers. End of quote. And ever since the British, of course, after the First World War, they sent, we were under British occupation, which was wrongly called British mandate. Then they sent a Zionist High Commissioner for Palestine, Samuel Herbert Samuel, who also has a very black history in Ireland, and a very important Irish person. And then we were under a British occupation. They facilitated everything for the migration of all Zionists from Europe. They armed them, gave them weapons, funded them, brought them, oppressed the Palestinians, until in 1948, the Nakba occurred. And the Nakba, the British, of course, were under British occupation, but they allowed the Zionists again at that time to occupy Palestine, and they did defend the Palestinians. Although, according to the mandate, Category A, which was imposed by the United Nations, this mandatory power should protect the people and prepare them for the right to seek determination. Instead of doing that, they, of course, handed over Palestine to the Jews. Now, it was Balfour, who is called in history of Ireland Bloody Balfour, because he had many people in Balfour's town. Then George Lloyd, who was also very Christian Zionist, who was also against the Irish people. Churchill, you know, one of the churches, we have many churches. One of them, the original church, Richard Churchill, said, the Protestants are right and they will fight. His grandson, Winston Churchill, said, I am a Zionist. And then you have the Blancantins, you know, Maxwell, who butchered the leaders of the 1916, and General Louis, those two generals, and General Montgomery, and those of those people who were in Ireland, butchered the Irish people, oppressed the Irish people, killed the Irish people, expropriated the Irish people. They did the same to the Palestinians. They were sent to Palestine. And they also sent not only this, but black and tans, that brutal police, the British police from different countries. Of course, they were, of course, who were brutalizing the Irish people. They were sent also by the British government to brutalize the Palestinian people. And then the Israelis today, they use the same administrative laws, administrative imprisonment in Israeli prisons in order to not to give any rights to the Palestinian people. And they can imprison them without giving them any rights and without telling them of any accusation, but just to bring, this is called administrative detention. And this administrative detention, the Israelis inherited it from the British colonial nose in Palestine. And you know that the Zionist movement is a settler colonial movement, and the British, colonialism was in total harmony with them. And then it is they who sent the Zionists to establish the settler colonial state. And settler colonialism is different from ordinary or classic colonialism. Settler colonialism is based on two logics. The first logic, dehumanization. The second logic, elimination. And this is what Israel is exactly practicing. And this is what Israel is doing now from Nakba and Land Down in 1948, and before that from Balfour Declaration, up to the ongoing genocide, which aims at the annihilation of the Palestinian people.
I mean, that is Abdallah is accepted as being a late 19th century idea. Ulster was the most rebellious province in Ireland, and the English couldn't settle it. So that's why they decided to colonize the land. And what's really interesting in the parallels, there are side unions in the north preach that 1,200 years ago, they actually left Ulster to go to Scotland. They were actually returning to their homeland. And where have we heard that before? God give the Jewish people the hubris of that God give it to them. And similarly, unionists would describe Ireland in the north of Ireland in the 16th century as Barham Land. There was no Beatty there. And they produced a land and they developed a land. And this mentality, in the sense, it's a political ideology about eliminating another people. It's about land grab. It's colonialism. It's imperialism. And that's why, I mean, you and I walked performers up yesterday and we did the advice to all of all the murals dedicated to the people of Gaza. But as you walk Northumberland Street on the Falls Road, as soon as you turn the corner towards the Shepherd Road, all the murals become pro-Israel and pro-empire. And I remember the UDA, Lawrence Bacalti, or Erasmus, in the 1973, actually describing themselves as Israelis. And the view in the Lawyers' Israeli flags. Why are they identified with Israel? Because it's the same story. They stole land. They stole land that wasn't theirs. They have to justify that. And one kid, God ever's in the equation because God gave it to them. And it is a crime. Absolutely a crime. But we were editing the book together. I came across a really interesting quote from the governor of Jerusalem. As Assad said, as the Black and Hans left down, Churchill descended on the puzzle. And this guy, Sir Ronald Storrs, who was the governor of Jerusalem from 1920 to 1948, he considered the Balfour Declaration and the partition of Palestine was to set up, quote, a little loyal Jewish Ulster in a sea of potential hostile Arabism. That's what that mentality prevails. And that's what we are up against. And that's why I consider Israel to be a seaboard for American imperialism in the Middle East, which it will control and dictate the policies. And has to look at the way it has affected the complexion of all the contiguous Arab nations around Palestine. And lastly, I would say this. There's two strands in the Irish struggle. One depends. One is constitutional, one is armed struggle. Where constitutionalism in this field, armed struggle has come up and a similar parallel in Palestine. When we were on the verge of getting home rule, which was just devolution, by the way, it wasn't Irish independence. The Brits were still the literal of foreign policy and tax, etc. When we were on the verge of getting the UVF in Ulster threatened civil war. And just as we were on the verge of getting the Third Home Rule Act passed, the First World War broke out. The British government said to the Irish volunteers, who had been campaigning for Home Rule, if you support us in the fight for small nations, Belgium, we will give you Home Rule at the end. And they said to the Unionists, if you support us during the First World War, we will make sure you keep out. You're kept out of all your perfidious Albion. 35,000 to 40,000 Irish people died. Believing that, that they were fighting for the independence of the country. Now, Britain did the same with India. If you fight for us, you will get independence at the end of this war. India did forget it until 1948, and then what it got was partition. 1 million people died when Lord Mountbatten, just overnight in 24 hours, partitioned that country, and they said the same to the Arab people. Fight for us, fight against the Ottoman Empire, and you will get independence at the end. Palestinians are still with independence. And that is one of the greatest injustices on this earth.
So we're going to keep discussing this, and I'm really excited about asking you about tactics and strategy and why some of them worked in Ireland, whether they could work in Palestine. But we're also really excited to bring onto the show virtually Hiva Butterly and Ty Kickey.
Everybody say hello.
Hope you guys enjoyed that. And to see the full show, including a segment with Ty Kickey, the great Irish comedian, please go to patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Now on to the second segment of this great show. And if you haven't already given it a thumbs up, make sure you do. Give it a like. And if you haven't already subscribed to the show, please do. Hit subscribe and then the bell. So this second part is an interview with three members of the organization Holocaust Survivors and Descendants Against the Genocide. And they are Holocaust survivor and artist and architect Stephen Kaposch, Holocaust survivor and musician Agnes Corey, and Haim Brashit Zobner, a historian, filmmaker, professor, and the son of two Holocaust survivors. He's also the author of the book An Army Like No Other about the IDF. And Haim was raised in Israel, by the way. So people may remember that Haim himself was arrested over a speech in which he said Israel wasn't going to be able to defeat Hamas. And in more recent news, the British police questioned Stephen Kaposch because the crackdown in England, in Germany, is increasing every minute now. And of course, in the United States as well, which is why I urge people to sign this petition that I'm linking to in the description for Mahmoud Khalil, who is the Columbia University student who was abducted basically by ICE. Okay, so now for Stephen, Agnes, and Haim. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining Haim Brashit Zobner, Stephen Kaposch, and making her debut on the Katie Halper Show, though I've interviewed her in person, Agnes Corey. Thank you for joining.
Thank you.
All right.
Hi, you are all members of the wonderful organization Holocaust Survivors and Descendants Against Genocide. And I wanted to ask each of you if you could just explain your relationship to the Holocaust. And then we're going to talk about how you, each of you, commemorated the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, otherwise known as Holocaust Memorial Day.
My connection to the Holocaust is that I was a child survivor. I was 7 years old when the German Allied armies invaded Hungary, because Hungary by that time was in, we're talking about 1944, March 1944, and Hungary by that time proved to be an unreliable ally. So the Germans invaded, they brought in Eichmann with them, and immediately deportation started, but initially from the countryside, very rapid deportations by sort of the summer. And unfortunately, there has been quite a keen cooperation from the Hungarians in doing that. Admiral Horthy was the titular head of state, and he kind of kept his distance from all this, but actually, by not obstructing it, he facilitated it. And under him, there were extreme fascist politicians who keenly took part in this action.
And what happened to you personally, and what happened to your family members?
Well, there were a series of laws introduced right after the arrival of the Germans, tightening up anti-Jewish laws, which have started in a milder form way before the Germans' arrival. But it became rapidly more and more difficult. I had to wear the red yellow star. We were concentrated into designated houses stamped with large yellow stars, where all Jews had to stay. And there were other restrictions on travel. When the out and out fascist groups, the Arrow Cross, took over power after October 44, there were all kinds of raids, and they did deport rather randomly, and even went further than that with summary executions, etc. During that time, I was already in hiding on false papers and false name in what turned later to be an archipelago of homes. It was horrendous fighting and demolition all around. We had to relocate several times because of war damage, bombed and shot to pieces in various places. The burning castle and us sort of escaping in lines by the side of it, and at other times we were had to be relocated, going through back gardens and in the snow and being shot at by the nearby Russian front, who couldn't see whether we were soldiers or kids or what, and just dots in the snow. And I wasn't particularly afraid, I have to say, because I couldn't fully appreciate the danger yet. In retrospect, I realized the terrible state of the adults around who fully realized the dangers.
And how many relatives did you lose?
I lost 15, you know, altogether, all of them from the countryside.
What was their relationship to you?
Uncles and cousins, mostly.
Right. Okay.
And there were relations, more distant relations in the south of Hungary. They also were deported to Auschwitz. That was it, really. And if I added up, it's 15. Now, some returned. They survived Auschwitz working. But this is links to my anti-Zionism, because when I visited them, this particular cousin who had such horrendous experience was militant Zionist and was absolutely racist against the indigenous Arab population of Haifa, which is where they ended up. And again, my aunt, who was also involved in the rescue operations, extremely bravely in at times, you know, almost heroic things. She was a out and out racist as well, Zionist. Despite the fact that she converted to Christianity, which she kept quiet in Haifa, on one occasion when we were watching television together, and there was news, and there was a Palestinian demonstration going on. This is the 60s, early 70s, late 60s. And gunships appeared, helicopter gunships appeared over the crowd and shooting into it, whether it was live ammunition or rubber bullets. It's pretty bad either way. And I was absolutely shocked. And she said to me, "What's the problem? They are all Arabs."
Right. And what about you, Agnes? Can you tell us what happened to you and your family?
I am, like Stephen, from Hungary, and I'm from Budapest, and I am also officially a Holocaust child survivor, but I'm about 7 years younger than Stephen. So my role during the worst possible times was trying to be born. That was my job. And my mother was in hiding with false papers. And I think she was supposed to be, according to that, a Protestant. So my mother was working as a cleaner with these papers. And she was doing that in a hospital because she was pregnant and she wanted to make sure that I can be born. And I was born in December 1944, under pretty horrendous circumstances. Interestingly or tragically, she had an extremely hard time during this period of hiding, not because she was Jewish, because most of the people around her where she worked didn't know that she was Jewish, but she was very badly treated because she was just a low-class nobody. So hatred is not just reserved for Jews, which you all know. Hatred is also reserved for all kind of people. And because of that, apparently, my life was permanently in danger. My mother wrote a very moving memoir, and she added a front page saying that this is for your 13th birthday, so that you remember and fight that such times never get repeated. And I took that seriously. I became a voluntary Holocaust researcher, not nonstop, because like I'm doing other things as well. Like my mother, I'm a music teacher. Basically, I'm doing whatever my mother told me. fight and music. My father was in Mauthausen, in the Mauthausen concentration camp, but he did return in August 1945. And he was strong and bitter, and he joined the Communist Party because of what happened. I did have an aunt in Auschwitz, and she actually survived. She came back and told me a few stories, not bedtime stories, needless to say. So that is my connection to the Holocaust.
Hi.
My family comes from Poland, from an area that changed hands between the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Poland, Ukraine, and Russia. So this was a place that kept changing hands. It's a small town, a modern town, where Jews were the majority, 80% of the population. Very unusually, because this was a steel production town, and the Jews were the workers in the Communist Party and in the Bund. The Zionists were basically not on the ground, and the few Zionists of the family left to Palestine in 1930-31. So the people that stayed there were people that planned to, you know, make a life in Poland. Basically, the Polish army, in which my father was drafted into immediately as the war began, gave up the ghost after a few weeks. And he came back to the town, and they were all put into a ghetto. My father used to tell me when I was young, and they spoke about the Holocaust all the time. I mean, they're not some of those people that never spoke about it. They spoke about it in order to make me and my sister ambassadors of the narrative. Yeah. Most of the Jews, the Jews basically worked the slave labor in the ghetto, producing ammunition and all kind of supplies, war supplies. By Pesach 1943, most of the ghetto was taken to Treblinka in a number of trains over 2 days. And they were all dead on arrival, basically. Within half an hour, they were already burnt. My father actually wrote a poem about his mother, his wife, and his three sisters taken by the Nazis. He was there. He was beaten up, and they were taken by the Nazis to Treblinka. He wasn't taken because he was working in what they called war industry. But he saw there, all of them taken, and he couldn't do anything. He was beaten, they stepped on him and beaten him. So by 1943, only the people working in the crucial industries were remaining. And both my parents, who are actually first cousins, were amongst those who remained in the ghetto. Both of them were on the train to Auschwitz on the 6th of June, 1944. They were actually in the same coach on the train. A third of the people in each coach died. Now, you have to understand, the town is very near Auschwitz. It's 15 kilometers as the crow flies. And a third of the people died because there was no food, there was no water. The two thirds that remained on entry to Auschwitz put to work, apart from those that were killed on arrival. They were put to work in Auschwitz I. They were in Auschwitz II, which is called Birkenau. Auschwitz I was mainly where the workers lived. So they didn't live in Auschwitz I, but they worked in chemical plants near Auschwitz I. My father actually worked on building aeroplanes, and because a number of times they tried to sabotage the work, he was beaten almost to death on two occasions. In January of 1945, on the 15th of January, the Russians were on the other side of the river from Auschwitz, and the Germans decided to take the last 6,000 men to Austria, and there were also 3,000 women. So both of them were taken on death marches, my mother to Bergen-Belsen and my father to a subcamp of Mauthausen called Gusen II, where they built aircraft inside the mountain. And they both walked all the way. So it took them about 2 weeks. And most of the people died on the road. It was a very cold January at the height of winter. And they were, dressed in those pajamas. Actually, in Gusen itself, they were not dressed in any way. They were totally naked. Normal people survived about 2 weeks there. That was the average. I don't know how my father survived until the last day of the war, which there was May the 8th. And he was freed by the Americans and actually filmed and interviewed by them. My mother ended up, as I said, in Bergen-Belsen, which wasn't a death camp, but people were dying like flies from diseases because the Nazis were, in a sense, they gave up on the population there because the population wasn't working in Bergen-Belsen. And my mother, like most of the other people there, had typhoid. And had the British come 3 or 4 days later, she would be dead. When the Red Cross had the books of survivors, which took them like 2 months to put together, she immediately searched for my father's name. She was in love with him for years, I think, but he was married. Now, of course, she knew that his wife is not alive. She wanted to meet him again because he was the only person actually that survived. They both were from the same family, and we lost about 120 people. My father and mother and one other cousin are the only people that survived from those 120 people. They wanted to go to America. It didn't happen. They wanted to go to the United Kingdom. It didn't happen. They wanted to go to lots of places. Those countries did not want the broken Jews that survived the Holocaust. They didn't want them. So in the end, they ended up going to Israel at the worst time. I was born in 46 in the summer, and in the summer of 48, so I wasn't even 2 years old, we went to Israel on the boat. All the men were trained militarily with rifles and the rest of it. They had drills on the boat. My father refused to take part in the drills and was duly arrested on arrival to Haifa because he refused to be drafted. I think he might have been, if not the first, maybe one of the first people who refused to be drafted on arrival in Palestine. Israel was 2 weeks old. He spent about 2 months in jail because he wouldn't give up. And then they said to him, you'll spend the rest of your life in jail. You won't see your wife. You won't see your baby. So he broke down and he agreed to be drafted, but only as a medic, an unarmed medic. And that's how he served. We were living in another jail that was converted for those from the other camps in Europe. They ended up in a camp in Palestine. And we ended up in a small town at the south of Jaffa called Jabalia, which was ethnically cleansed from its population of Palestinians. And we lived there for many years. Now, there was not an Israeli around for miles. Hebrew was spoken only by children, badly by me because I spoke Yiddish and Italian, which were my first languages. But it wasn't really part of Israel. We lived with Arab families that survived the Nakba, and our family survived the Holocaust. So everyone was a survivor.
Wow. What kind of sabotage was your father engaged in?
My father did sabotage with a number of, I mean, he was a Bundist. The family was not a Zionist. They were Bundists. Bund is an organization, yeah, in German or Yiddish. And the Socialist Bund was the largest Jewish party in Russia and in Poland. And they were anti-Zionist, very strongly anti-Zionist. And by a freak of history, they started in the same month in 1897. Those two movements, Zionism and Bundism, started by chance at the same time. And both of them wanted to resolve anti-Semitism. The Bundists resolved anti-Semitism by fighting with other socialists for a socialist country where they were. The Zionists didn't care about anti-Semitism very much and went to Palestine, of course. So that was the difference.
Well, thank you all for sharing your fascinating histories. How did each of you commemorate the Holocaust this year?
I went to an official Holocaust memorial day. It should be memorial or something like that, but it was more like celebration and festivities. It was very, very weird. Now, the place was fully filled with top politicians. Our Prime Minister Keith Starmer was there. But so was Prince William and Princess Kate, Catherine. So basically the Prince of Wales and the Princess of Wales. I wasn't happy with it for several reasons, not only because they didn't mention Palestine, but because to me the whole event was like a Hollywood show rather than anything to do with the real event. As a matter of fact, this afternoon I did write about it, and it is going to be published online, but that's just by the way. Now, I don't think I'm going to be invited for any of these gatherings anymore, because at the pre-event reception, politicians and high-standing Jews were kind of mingling and went and sat next to survivors, and God knows what made these two to come next to me. Well, how are you? Are you feeling okay? And I'm so sorry you went through the Holocaust. And then I changed the conversation, and I did say to the president of the Board of Deputies, now listen, and then I gave a few ideas of mine. He was very, very surprised, and he was very embarrassed. I did go on quite a bit. From there, I went to the Polish embassy, and I made a short speech against the Prime Minister of Israel, and I suggested that Poland should arrest him if he turned up in Auschwitz. And luckily or fortunately, as we all know, he didn't go to Auschwitz, but I did give a few ideas why he should be arrested.
Thank you. Stephen and Haim, do you want to share?
I was also invited as a Holocaust survivor, like Agnes, to the official thing. I knew that it was going to be provocative and unpleasant, basically, for me. But yeah. Anyway, they sent tickets. So that was the first event. And then in the afternoon, I went to the same one outside the Polish embassy because I was invited by IGEN. That was very close to the next event. I was asked to speak first, which I did fairly briefly, and left to be in time for Tony Greenstein's SLN's webinar, which was excellent, I think, or the other contributors at any rate. I concentrated on simply filling in stories of what it was like to be involved in the Holocaust and not in the camps necessarily, because there were some other horrors not in immediately obvious. It's mostly about things that happened to my family and my school friend, etc. Some pretty horrendous stories, very painful ones for those who lived through it. And I try to make a little bit of parallel with those pains and experiences and similar ones in Gaza. And for example, the pain of divided families, the pain of having to make life and death decisions about the next move without reliable information, virtually gambling with the life of a family. There was really concentrated destruction in that part of Budapest. I think disproportionately so, because that's where the climax of the fighting was. And when we came out at the end of it, we were surrounded by heaps of rubble and destruction. And that really rhymed with what I've seen of Gaza very much, except ours, such concentrated destruction was in a small part of Budapest. There's one difference still, that whereas in Gaza, the destruction is a deliberate act. It's a complete obliteration by decision. Our destruction was a byproduct of genuine armies fighting. So there was less of a visible expression of hatred than what it is in Gaza. It was pretty horrifying, and one that we protested in the midday Jewish commemoration is the protest against the misuse of the Holocaust experience. It is pretended that what has been going on ever since the fake anti-Semitism business started up within the Labour Party and then now extended to the whole country, pretty much, is this concept or idea of saving Jews, solidarity with the IDF attack on Gaza, which is a total misconception and misuse and desecration of the memory of the Holocaust. And we had protested that at the midday ceremony and the interviews following.
And what about you, Chaim?
I couldn't actually partake in the Holocaust Memorial Day events because I was in hospital as part of my treatment, and I knew that beforehand. I probably wouldn't have gone to any of the official ones because I detest so much the use, like my friends here, detest the abuse of the memory of so many millions by politicians and others making use of it. But I did partake as a speaker with three others in another commemoration called Genocide Memorial Day. Dr. Ahmed, who is a British expert in treating burns at the beginning of the genocide, he moved to Gaza, where his family is from, and he moved to Gaza with his two daughters and his wife. I thought this was amazing, and what is more amazing is that they all survived. And he told us in half an hour what it was like not to be able to give people any help most of the time because he didn't have not just medications and swabs and so on. He didn't have clean water and he couldn't do anything for most of the people who were burnt by the Israeli bombs. So in a sense, this was a very interesting way of speaking about the Holocaust because it was in context. It was in context with what is happening around us, with what is actually destroying the Palestinian people in a similar way that the Jews were destroyed. But the difference being that the Jews were the victims in the past and now they are the perpetrators. And they didn't admit it to the patients. He spoke about it and we all cried. He said we had to have an area where people that we cannot help at all had to be kept. And, you know, some people pretended to help them, but there was nothing that they could do because they didn't have anything to give them to relieve their pain. They had just to die quietly. Each can hold their hand and not much more than that. I think this was even worse than some of the descriptions of the Holocaust during the Second World War.
And we should also remind people that, you know, this is a policy decision, right? Like the fact that he can't provide people with things, this is not some inevitability of war. This is because Israel refuses to let certain things in. Israel is not letting in anesthesia. So people are undergoing amputations without anesthesia. I mean, it's just the most barbaric, unnecessary, intentional suffering.
Now, Prime Minister in Britain, who happens to be the only human rights lawyer running a country, Keir Starmer, actually said, not once, not twice, and not three times, that Israel is right in what it is doing in Gaza and has a right to do it, including, you know, starvation, withdrawal of water, electricity, medications, and so on.
I was at the same event, and I can second that the Palestinian doctor's presentation was overwhelming, moving presentation. And it's very true that despite the temporary ceasefire, because of those deprivations and lack of infrastructure for over 2 million people, the genocide is ongoing, despite of lack of fighting, because it will take many months to turn the ship round, even if it is allowed. With the supplies and rebuilding, but there is no sign that it is being allowed. So further casualties by large numbers continuing as the ceasefire supposedly is holding or semi-holding.
I think I should mention something that the doctor has said, which really shocked us because we didn't know about it, and I think people elsewhere don't know about it. The United States and Britain each have contributed a field hospital, a modern field hospital, each to be built in Gaza, and they were built in Gaza. The hospital, each of them, cost a few tens of millions of pounds, and in the American one, there were 60 doctors, and in the British one, something like 40 doctors and nurses. They never treated a single patient. From the beginning to the end, the British and the Americans donated the prefab hospital. Yeah, they built a hospital from prefabricated expensive parts. There were no medications there. There were no beds there. There was no way of treating anyone. This was just a building, very expensive building. But they harmed Palestinians enormously because they actually advertised and got about 100 doctors to work in those two hospitals. No, they didn't do anything because there was nothing for them to do, but they were taken out of the count of, you know, disappearing doctors in Gaza because so many of them died. So doctors believed they will be treating people, and they went to work there and got paid for it, but they didn't do the work. So this is how the US and UK help Israel to kill more people. Now, no one can argue that they didn't know what they're doing, making sure that those doctors are not treating patients. And this went on for more than 6 months.
I just would like to clarify. I didn't go to this Guildhall ceremony and also to the Radio Free concert recordings out of curiosity, because I wanted to see what it was like.
Right.
I keep going into the lion's dens.
Right.
And I do that repeatedly because it's easy to make speeches to people who agree with you. That's fun. You know, it's so nice. I want to know what the other side thinks, feels, and I want to put my arguments forward in the hope that who knows what. So that's what I'm trying to say. Also, I would like to say that I'm ever so sorry, but I really need to leave.
Okay. Thank you, Agnes. Thank you so much, Agnes.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much.
I actually wanted to ask you to respond to something that I think is pretty relevant right now. I'm not sure if you saw this, but someone who is on the board of trustees of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Council wrote an op-ed. His name is Martin Olinaire. And the title of the op-ed that he wrote at the Jerusalem Post was "Let Donald Trump Make Gaza Great Again." And he says that he does not believe Gazans are worthy of any mercy. And he does also believe, he says, let's not mince words here. The people of Gaza are collectively guilty for invading Israel, murdering, raping, and kidnapping Israelis and holding them hostage. And he believes that they are not worthy of any mercy. And this, again, is someone who is not only on the board of directors of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Council, but also the son of a Holocaust survivor. So I wanted to know your response to this.
Look, there are many Jews that are reacting like this. Some people say you have to forgive them, you have to understand them. I don't forgive them. I don't understand them. I don't accept that this is at all Jewish. I think what happened in the last 80 years since the Holocaust is that Zionism has not only occupied Palestine, but it occupied the mind of Jews and others, but definitely the mind of most Jews. And those Jews have abandoned Judaism in favor of Zionism. Zionism is hostile to Judaism, is hostile to humanity. In 2,000 years of life in Europe, Jews have suffered a lot, but they have never been involved in genocide. They have never been involved in mass murders. Others murdered them. Others genocided them, but they have never used terrible ways of treating other human beings. The Jewish religion and tradition and history and experience is an experience which is cosmopolitan, internationalist, humane, based on the best traditions of the prophets, and was the basis, together with Islam and Christianity, which have also claims on morality, was the basis of the UN Declaration of Human Rights. That declaration could never have been written in the way that it was if not for that experience of 2,000 years of Judaism I'm not saying everywhere, not in the Arab world. In the Arab world, they lived in peace and equality. But in Europe, the history of Jews is very painful. That somebody like that person. I don't want to say that Jew because I don't give him the honor of being called a Jew. Someone like that who speaks like a Nazi, who speaks hatefully about human beings that are killed in his name, I think that is the worst thing that can happen to Jews or to humans. And I don't consider them part of a community of humans and definitely not a community of proper Jews. Proper Jews are the Neturei Karta that are walking 12 miles every Saturday to central London so they can partake in the movement against the genocide, and then they walk 12 miles back. These are proper Jews. Proper Jews are Jews like us who are supporting the Palestinians because this is what our history and our historical experience and our culture and our religion are teaching us how to treat other human beings. Now, of course, in Judaism itself, there are some seeds of racism. For example, how the goy should be treated, the non-Jew. I think this is the case in every single religion. The other is actually considered non-human. This is a weakness that Jewish monotheism is sharing with other monotheism. But the Jews themselves, for 2,000 years, would have been horrified by what this man is saying. And I'm horrified, and Stephen is horrified, and other tens of thousands of Jews in Britain who have now turned to support Palestine are horrified. And of course, in the United States, even more are horrified and have abandoned Zionism. So that's how I treat this kind of views of Judaism.
At the beginning of this person's statement, there is a sort of routine, exaggerated reference to October 7. And he trots out the sort of multiple rape, etc., accusations, which are vastly exaggerated. They haven't been able in subsequent investigations to find a single eyewitness.
Right. And some of eyewitnesses have recanted and have been debunked.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And of course, other invented horrors like the 40-headed, beheaded babies, etc. So there is that on the one side, in considering the excuse for all the horrors that they perpetrated. The numbers that are quoted as casualties or victims for that day are completely exaggerated because of the Hannibal directive's practical action. And I think more information came out in the last few days about that, of how many rounds they had been expending, etc. And I know that the first line fighters do not rape because it's not practical, quite simply. They are about survival and chasing down the enemy. It is the second and third wave of semi-drunkard, fairly safe troops that do the damage, which they did in Budapest as well. So that's another, you know, just by the way, I instinctively feel the exaggeration there. There has never been an impartial, independent investigation of the true casualties of October the 7th. And if there was one, I'm pretty convinced that the numbers would come down dramatically.
Yes. There is no justification for genocide. Right. Whoever does it, whenever and wherever. That's what he's justifying.
Right. And I do wonder if he ever spoke out against the actually documented rape cases committed by Israeli soldiers of Palestinian detainees that Israeli media doesn't deny, Israeli politicians don't deny. They actually defend it, like the famous case of the Knesset member saying it was legitimate to insert sticks into people's rectums.
All that is happening to human animals in their eyes, so that's okay. Right.
The woman responsible for bringing rapists to justice on the 7th of October admitted that there is not a single woman that came forward and gave evidence, and not a single woman gave evidence of something that she saw, not one that experienced and not one that saw,
right,
came forward and gave evidence. So there is no evidence, and there never has been any, of either beheaded babies or rapes. And yet, all leaders of the West are mouthing these lies day and day after day. The Holocaust Educational Trust that looks after this Holocaust Memorial Day refused to invite any of us, and our many organizations refused totally involvement of Jews who are not part of the Jewish organized society by Zionism. Now, what we have to ask ourselves is, how is it possible that after 80 years of commemorating genocide against Jews in Israel, and abroad, the Israelis then, with help from people abroad, are then conducting a genocide? What was the point of 80 years of commemoration if at the end they actually practically committed genocide? What was the point of 80 years of Holocaust commemoration if at the end this is the result? We asked the King Charles III, to correct the way that the Holocaust Educational Trust is behaving, as he is the patron of the trust. He didn't answer us, and neither did the Holocaust Education Trust. But they have made sure that Gaza and the genocide in Gaza is not mentioned anywhere in a Holocaust commemoration event.
There has been a crackdown on protests and dissent against pro-Palestinian voices, people who just think that Palestinians are human beings, since Keir Starmer's time in office. And Chaim, you experienced that with your arrest last year, and your crime was saying that that Israel was not going to defeat Hamas, which is something that, since you've said that, Tony Blinken said that. So maybe this is, I'll go after him. Right, right.
Tony Greenstein said also, that was a statement of fact. He said the UN Convention of Human Rights allow people under occupation, resistance, right, even with the force of arms. This is a fact.
Right. It's just international law.
On that, right, he is now standing under the Terror Act and can be actually up to 14 years in prison. 14 years in prison is more than any murderer is getting. So for that sentence, he is now facing accusations that may bring 14 years in prison. This is totally mad. Yeah. Actually, a woman who is a filmmaker, Helena, who made films about Stephen, about Tony, about me, about a whole number of people, also was arrested. You know, so, you know, anyone that is trying to tell the truth about what is going on in Britain is going to be in jail.
And final question from me, I wanted to get your thoughts on this. There's been a lot of talk about Elon Musk and the salute, but I actually was more curious about your thoughts on something he said when speaking to, I believe, he was actually speaking to the AFD, and he said, I think there's too much focus on past guilt in Germany, and we need to move beyond that. Children should not feel guilty for the sins of their parents, their great-grandparents even.
That's a very empty statement, because in practice, a lot of what they do is connected to their permanent sense of guilt. And they and the guilt of their action is then visited on the Palestinians.
Exactly, right.
A complete displacement, but at roots, it's not unrelated to their guilt over the original World War II genocide. And probably the same goes for Poland with all those anti-Semitic back history. They suddenly have to demonstrate their extreme support.
One other thing he said, it's okay to be proud to be German and not to lose that in some sort of multiculturalism that dilutes everything. And this, by the way, is someone who has been defended by the Anti-Defamation League. But
well, of course it would be. Yeah. I mean, the Anti-Defamation League is itself a defaming organization.
Right.
The number one brain near the brainless Trump is actually organizing the fascists and neo-Nazis of Europe into a new political force, is telling us what is coming. This is a terrifying appointment that Trump has come up with.
As for his running down of multiculturalism, I came to this country in 1956. And at that time, there were still legal notices in shop windows about advertising flats saying no blacks or Irish need apply. Mm. That was in 56. And if I have been governor in a couple of schools until fairly recently in my retirement, and there has been a successful integration of the young generation and their parents, obviously. I found in both schools about 50% of the children were of color, and they were happily living and learning and playing together with the indigenous population. And so it was a considerable success, no matter what Musk says.
Right. Well, thank you so much to both of you. This has been really amazing.
Thank you guys so much for watching the show. And of course, please give the stream a like, give it a thumbs up, subscribe if you haven't already subscribed by hitting subscribe and then the bell. And we will see you next week. Bye, everyone.
Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show, where for just $1 a month, you help make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks, and my upcoming documentary and early access interviews. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, and Brad Bloom. Brad Bloom and Andrew Calloway are the audio engineers, and our researcher is Nate Newborn. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.